If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it. Hello, and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Michael Z. An author and cook, Michael is the creator of Symmetry Breakfast, which started out as an Instagram account before amassing over 670,000 followers and becoming one of the most popular food books of 2016. He's now based in Italy and known for his particular brand of British Chinese fusion food. His third book, Zhao Fan, Breakfast of China, is out now. Michael, welcome to Table Talk.
Fantastic, it's my absolute pleasure.
Michael, we always start at the beginning. What are your earliest memories of food?
So I actually have quite a lot of memories of food from when I was very, very young. I actually grew up in chippies and takeaways and Chinese restaurants that my family had long before I was born. And so I remember summer holidays spent working in a chippy in Liverpool. I remember going to Chinese supermarkets, but then I also remember going to my mother's side of the family in Scotland and the sort of, you know, nouvelle cuisine that the Glaswegians love so much, sort of like, you know, iron brew and pizza crunch and all these things. I have really strong memories of my grandmother's coconut cake. Yeah, so it's a very eclectic mix of things. I think food was always, I wouldn't say it was necessarily a super celebrated part of my childhood. It was just always there.
And your grandfather, I think I'm right in saying, ran a restaurant in Liverpool, and I think you helped out in your family restaurants when you were younger. Could you talk a little bit about what that was like?
So my grandfather came to England before the Second World War. He was in shipping, you know, after the war finished, and he settled in Liverpool. He was this kind of very entrepreneurial Shanghainese man who started opening basically what he thought would work as a foreigner in Liverpool, which was Chinese restaurants. And, you know, over the decades from the kind of 50s to the mid-noughties, we had different Chinese restaurants in the family, different levels of kind of customer price points, you know, sit-down buffet, Chinese chippies, he had a small empire. And even when I was maybe, gosh, like 7 or 8 years old, my dad would pick me and my two brothers and sister from school, and we would go and work for a few hours in a restaurant or a chippy. And that was kind of, you know, cheap labor, but also easy babysitting. Yeah. and on weekends and school holidays, we would just be at a restaurant all the time. I mean, I didn't actually, you know, go on a holiday until I was 18. Like, you know, a proper, you know, I'm going away for leisure. Mm. School holidays were spent working.
How did that influence the way that you see food, both British food and Chinese food? That kind of fusion, how did that influence your attitude to food?
I think as a child, you're not so, you don't ask that many questions of, is this authentic, mummy? Where's this coming from? Who was the origin? You just kind of, I was raised in a very kind of, you eat what you're given. And so only as I got older and went to China as an adult, I suddenly realized that what we were eating growing up was a real patchwork of not just even Shanghainese food, but kind of pan China, Southeast Asia, and these kind of dishes that were collected by my grandfather on his travels, of the sort of things he just liked to eat. Mm. And that just became what we ate. And so, you know, I sort of understand or I kind of accept this sort of fluidity, but also the kind of food we ate was a reflection of my grandfather's preferences. You know, he arrived in England at a time where, you know, he comes from a tradition where, you know, your table for dinner is full of dishes and you share family style. And obviously he was given then the opportunity to cook that meal, and he just omitted the things that he didn't like. Mm. You know, he didn't like that vegetable, so he just didn't cook it. So you grow up with these missing pieces, but you're unaware that they're missing.
Mm.
You don't know any better. So, but I did know that as a kid, the sort of food we ate at home and the sort of Chinese dishes my dad would cook, because my dad was the chef as well in the restaurants, I knew that they were not the sort of things that were sold to the rest of the people. And the dishes we cooked were maybe a bit more exotic or a bit more, not necessarily extravagant, but more maybe more pungent, more vinegary, more extreme for a British palate, especially in Liverpool in the 80s, 90s.
And what about school food? What was school food like in Liverpool in the 80s, 90s?
I remember it being so bad, but actually just loving it so much. I remember, you know, all the kind of, we'd have break time and you'd have a tuck shop and people would sell, you know, flapjacks and donuts and obviously all things that are kind of terrible today, or you maybe kind of think, maybe is that the best thing to give to kids? But I remember school lunches being great. I very rarely took a packed lunch. I would eat at the school. And I just remember it being like a really good time. I didn't go to a particularly big school. I think, you know, when I hear people's experiences, I think maybe I was quite fortunate to have something where we actually had dinner ladies cooking actual food. Mm. It wasn't what I imagine today.
And given your culinary background, Michael, people might assume that it was always sort of your destiny to go into the world of food, but you've actually, you know, you've had a more kind of varied career than that. You studied photography at the Arts Institute at Bournemouth, and then you went on to become an art and design teacher, and you've worked for the Tate Britain and the V&A. So can you give me a bit of sort of that background and how you then ended up into the world of food?
So the photography thing was really my dad. Before I was born, he was a Royal Engineer, and he was his regiment's photographer. And so I was born into a home where we had a black and white darkroom in the airing cupboard upstairs. It was, you know, two people could stand in this tiny space, and we had an enlarger and developing trays. And my dad would, you know, shoot black and white film, process himself at home, and we'd print, you know, contact sheets and things like this. And I remember using a film camera maybe by the age of 8 or 9, having a Pentax K2, really super robust camera that, you know, it's a very manual, and always kind of enjoying photography and having a family with, you know, tons of photo albums, and just that being, you know, my dad always had a camera, and my mother as well. She also, my dad got her into photography in this kind of amateur way in the 70s. So photography for me was kind of, I loved it. I did it A-level as well. And then, you know, the minute I thought, okay, what do I want to do at university? I applied for 6 colleges in photography. So went to study photography in Bournemouth, absolutely loved it, graduated thinking, okay, now what? What do I do with this as a job? I was completely clueless. And so I became a school teacher and did the PGC. And that was really eye-opening, you know, work. And I was actually not that much older than the students that I was teaching, because I went to university quite young, and so I was only maybe 2 or 3 years older than the students that I had at A-level. So I think for a moment I was, you know, running on sort of faking it till you make it. And then, you know, school teaching was a interesting experience, not necessarily the one I'd thought that it would be, in that many people struggle in schools to teach, and there's all those sorts of issues around retention in schools. And so I then went to do a master's in education and then sidestepped into museums. And the museum thing was really where it kind of opened up for me, and, you know, especially the V&A, and you were in this magnificent museum of stuff, and how everything kind of cross-pollinates, all the ideas across galleries, across disciplines, across materials, across times, really, you know, about how artists express themselves through porcelain or through textiles. It was really the eye-opener working with kids in that space to kind of say, why is it a 17-year-old kid from an inner borough of London should be interested in a Ming vase? You know, what is it you've got to get them the hook, to get them interested in something. And all these kind of small skills of showing kids and just watching them light up of like, wow, this is relevant to me. This Mantua court dress, 1700s, is suddenly an interesting object to me. That was really, you know, that really then fed through into the Instagram, into social media. As I was running Symmetry Breakfast at the beginning, I was going to work at the B&A every day. Mm. Wake up 5-6 in the morning, cook, post a picture, cycle to the B&A, go to work. It was like that for 3 years.
And Michael, just for listeners who aren't aware of Symmetry Breakfast, could you just explain a little bit about what it is and why you started it?
So it was around, you know, Instagram was a new app, 2010, 2011. And I was a very early adopter. You know, I loved photography and, you know, I had an iPhone and, you know, smartphones were just relatively new. And these kind of apps were just pure photo sharing apps. They were just for the joy of sharing pictures. There was no concept of influencers or activations or, you know, any of this terminology that we associate with social media today didn't exist. And I was just posting pictures of food and random things. And it was really after I met Mark, who's now my husband. And he was working for Burberry, designing the runway. And he would have an incredibly busy schedule that meant that we only really saw each other at breakfast. And it was that that kind of the time frame of saying, okay, breakfast is when we had to chat and catch up and plan the weekend and, you know, have a life. And so let's make that moment nice. And he was really the breakfast guy. I was more just a cup of coffee. And so it was him. And also because he's Dutch, you know, asking him things like, well, what do you eat? What is a typical Dutch breakfast? Let me try and make that. And just that kind of interest of, you know, a new love and saying, oh, what, let me make something that makes you happy. Let me try and research that. Let me find a recipe for that. Let me try and make that from scratch. And things like this that really, you know, started the kind of process of exploring food culture and taking pictures of it. And it was then, you know, just by pure accident, one day I laid on the table and I was like, oh, that looks kind of pretty. Symmetrical. They're nice plates. And the light's lovely. And let me just take a picture on my phone. And it was really only a few months later that Mark's boss at the time said, I really like these pictures. You should maybe make a separate account for them. And I remember Symmetrical Breakfast was too long. So I was like, okay, Symmetry Breakfast, that'll do. And I was in a pub in Chelsea and we were watching a football match and I was just setting this account up on my phone. And that was really it. And then, you know, 2,000 pictures later, and it's kind of grown into something that's a bit of a career.
And you're sort of one of the original food influencers on Instagram. What do you think is the secret to presenting food on Instagram? Is it all about the photography, or is it the right type of food? What seems to work, and also what doesn't work?
You have to get certain technical aspects out of the way. Photography has to be good. Quality of editing has to be good. You have to have a certain message. That those are the sorts of nuts and bolts of things. And I think, put those aside for a moment. I definitely think there's certainly value in sticking to your guns, sticking to your niche. I did Symmetry Breakfast every single day for 7 years, to the point where I felt like I'm going crazy. This thing is really ruling my life. And how can I actually step back from that a moment and reflect and make it work for me? And so I think that is a really important point. I think the other most important thing I've learned is that, you know, in my success in social media, I can't let it rule me. I think what's the most important thing is that, you know, there was a moment where I thought, who's more important, Michael Z or Symmetry Breakfast? Who's more important, the account or the person? And I always admire how Jamie Oliver went from the naked chef to 1 minute just being Jamie Oliver. And I think the thing is, when you work alone, like I do, I don't have any assistants or managers. I just me in my kitchen with my phone. you know, you can somehow become very doubtful of your abilities, but also you maybe care too much and you worry too much because you don't have someone to reassure you. In many ways, that influencers do work. So most influencers I know are freelancers. So you definitely need someone to say, I don't think it's that important if you stop being Symmetry Breakfast, if you go on, if you evolve, the evolution is okay. But so many people get worried by the brand. The brand overrides you. I think that's really crucial that you build something that gives you the flexibility to actually enjoy it.
And after your first book came out and after you and your husband had married, you moved to Shanghai. What was it like living in Shanghai, and what was your experience of the food there in comparison to the food that you'd experienced in the UK?
So we moved January 2017. And both Mark and I had actually been to China many times before. I'd actually been many, many times. He'd been two or three, I think, and for work and for pleasure. And my sister was living in Beijing, but, you know, never lived there. When you go as a kind of a short trip, you barely scratch the surface. But the sort of immediate feeling was, it was overwhelming. There is just so much going on in such a large space, a large city, that kind of dwarfs Western cities in many ways. It does feel overwhelming. You have to kind of work out a way to cut through a lot of noise, a lot of chaos. And it is somewhere that I feel that you can very quickly find a level of comfort, because for me, the difference between, let's say, Milan or London to a Chinese city is that the Chinese really take convenience very seriously, and whether that convenience actually trumps beauty or what seems like a good idea on paper or design on paper. Actually, a lot of Chinese cities are designed around, how do we eat? How do we sleep? How do we commute? How do we enjoy leisure? And sometimes the sort of kind of master plan beauty of Chinese cities like Shanghai, sometimes it, from an immediate viewpoint, can look very ugly. But actually, when you live there, you realize how easy life is.
That's interesting. And tell listeners about your new book, Zhao Fan, Breakfast of China. What's particularly about breakfast in China? How does Chinese breakfast differ to British breakfast?
To British breakfast, I'm not going to lie, to British breakfast, there's actually a lot of there's a lot of similarities, actually. I mean, overwhelmingly, Chinese breakfast is savoury. Sugar is a very small part of the diet in the morning times. So, you know, you'll kind of fry up a Chinese person who is used to kind of steam buns and filled with maybe some pork or noodles, and it's hot and it's savory and it's salty and with eggs and things like that. A Chinese person might actually not be so revolted by an English breakfast. They might probably think it's quite good. But for certain, the huge difference is the ceremony, the performative side of Chinese food. A lot of food is made to order. There's a sense of performance there where the chef makes right in front of you, the cook right in front of you, your portion. This pancake is for you. It's not like you go into a Greg's and it's all there and they just take one out the hot box. That pancake, those hand pulled noodles, that bun, the dumplings are made for your personal order, and you'll just take a seat and they'll be ready in 1 minute. And I think that is an enormous difference. This level of it's the theatre of putting the food on show, and that's two reasons. There's one to show how fresh it is, and you know, the skill, but also to show that transparency over the fact that they're not doing anything dodgy. You know, there's a lot to be said about the stereotypes of Chinese food. And, you know, a few examples of food scandals over a decade ago now still stick in the mind of many Westerners, but most Chinese people pick their food options based on, you know, is that fish still alive when I'm ordering it? So you go to the supermarket, that you don't buy a plastic wrapped fish, you buy a live fish and they kill it for you in front of you and you take it home. You know, so I find that also, you know, the level of energy in the wet markets, in these spaces where you buy food, the level of kind of energy is so much higher because things are living.
Hmm. And you now live in Italy. How is that starting to shape your attitude to food?
I think, so we actually lived in Italy now for over 2 years. We left China 2021 and I was going back and forth during COVID about five times to finish the book. So I would say that first year I wasn't really here that much. And also, you know, there was all this kind of mess with the Green Pass and things here. But I think for me, Italy is extremely unique within Europe. It for sure has one of the highest and deepest food cultures in Europe. And they're very good at maintaining it and protecting it. I honestly see that the food standards quality here is phenomenal. And the diversity that does exist. I would personally, though, say that sometimes the regulations get in the way of innovation. And I would say that maybe the diversity is sometimes overestimated for marketing purposes. I definitely think that for me, the best food in Italy is not in the cities, it's in the countryside. I think there's enormous diversity in the mountains and in the flats, in the Venetian Lagoon, that is somehow sidestepped for a good marketing PR machine. And that's a shame, because there is enormous diversity here, and there's kind of two Italies. There's, you know, the easily digestible one of carbonara and spritz, and then there's the actual incredible food culture here that maybe is not always palatable either. You know, you also get things that I look at in Italy and think, wow, that's very Chinese. In fact, you know, this dessert's made with blood and pancakes made with blood. And, you know, they eat a lot of organs in very extravagant ways. One of my favorite dishes from the Roman kitchen is called paiata, which is a kind of cruel way to kill a baby cow, but that makes a lovely pasta dish.
there you go.
So there you go. And I find that there's enormous complexity that's maybe missed. Also because Italy's industrial, for sure, the Italy's food culture was richer 100 years ago, and it's disappearing because of industrialization. And that is happening in China, but at a slower rate. In China, there's a delay because the Industrial Revolution started later. And so Italy's losing its diversity because of a million reasons. People are living in cities and the generation of nonnas are dying out, and certain foods that maybe are specific to a holiday or an occasion are not being cherished or recorded. I think there's a problem here that maybe is not being recognised.
And I was going to ask you, Michael, have you been able to find good Chinese food in Italy? Obviously, you're saying there are influences, but what about actual Chinese food? Have you found it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I was actually just in Venice at the weekend, and in Mestre, which is the town on the mainland, the first town as you go from the island back onto the mainland, there's a very large community from Wenzhou. Wenzhou is a Chinese city, South China, stereotypically famous for being good business people, a very, very business-minded city. And they have an even bigger community in Prato, in Tuscany. And these are communities that came, you know, mid-20th century to work in factories, as particularly garment factories, leather factories, shoes, things like that, especially the fashion industry. And, you know, the Chinese are extremely adept at technical skills, sewing, you know, manufacturing. So they came over slowly, and eventually this kind of community has grown. And so you get fantastic Wenzhouese food in Italy. Of course, there are other sort of the other regions, Sichuan. There's some good, great dim sum in Milan. There's some great Beijing restaurants in Rome. But Wenzhenese is by far the largest community here, and they do amazing cuisine.
And Michael, just to finish, we normally like to ask our guests what their desert island meal would be. What is your ultimate meal if you could just pick one meal?
If I'm going to pick a last meal, it's Chinese. It's for sure going to be char siu baos. Char siu bao is this fluffy bun from Cantonese cooking with the sweet red kind of pork inside. And I've had like a love affair with this since I was a kid. It's the one thing, dim sum. It's like, if I don't order it, I'm going to be annoyed. It's will stay with me forever. And there's you know, it's one of these things that I sometimes feel like, should I get that as a tattoo? Not that I have any. But, you know, when people get tattoos, they're usually things that are deeply meaningful or not, or complete opposite. But I feel like, you know, a char siu bao, what would that look like as a tattoo? It'd probably look awful. But no, char siu bao is forever, every day. Could probably eat them every day.
Would you have pudding?
Oh, there's actually, I mean, one thing I would love to try, maybe not my desert island meal in a sense, but my death row meal. There's one Italian dessert that I'm desperate to try, but it's one of these things that it's impossible to find, is a sanguinaccio dolce, which is when they slaughter the pig and they drain the blood and they add cocoa powder and make chocolate mousse. And it is something that, you know, you cannot create in a restaurant. You cannot create it, you know, in a, you can't buy it in the supermarket. You have to be on location, on a farm, on the day that they slaughtered the pig. And, you know, they collect the blood and make the blood sausage and all the, you know, they butcher the animal. And with the little bit that's left over, they make a little sweet treats. And that was traditionally a way in to give children an understanding that the sadness of killing this animal can actually be delicious. And I've tried for years to try and find someone. Are you killing a pig soon? Are you killing a pig soon? Can I come? No, it's not. I have to drive 250 miles. Maybe not. So I feel if my last meal, I would love to try it, because, you know, if it's terrible, then it's my last meal.
Michael, thank you very much for joining Table Talk. And Michael's new book, Zhao Fan, Breakfast of China, is available now.